Hello and welcome to the Recreation to Recreation podcast, the show where we explore the stories of people who have turned the activity that they love into positive change for our world. My name is Jen, and I'll be your sidekick on this adventure as we treasure hunt for gems of insight and wisdom while exploring the planet with our inspiring guests. For today's adventure, we're heading to Canada, Japan, and beyond with Malcolm to explore his world of memory, illusion, and the art of preservation. Hi, Malcolm. How are you?
I'm good, Jen. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for joining me today. So for those who are listening, this is a very special interview for me. It's someone that I wanted to interview since I began my podcast. You are going to be listening to me talk to my brother.
Yeah, the other child.
I've personally been looking forward to this for a long time, and he finally agreed. So without further ado, Malcolm, I'm wondering if you can tell us where you are, what it's like there, and get us situated in your world.
I am in my studio, which is near Lake Huron here in Ontario, and it is dark outside, cool, feels like it might rain, so it's a perfect evening.
As you well know, because you've been a very kind listener of the podcast, we get to do the weird and wonderful questions.
Oh boy.
Okay. First things first, which Disney character do you feel affinity with?
There's a couple villains that I probably feel the closest affinity to. And I don't think that should reflect poorly on my personality, I hope. I've always really enjoyed the original Maleficent from the cartoon from the 50s. Elegant, thoughtful, a little strange, a little solitary. I think villains are underappreciated sometimes, character-wise. I think they're more often than not misunderstood, and there's usually some sort of core hurt at the bottom of them. And that's not why I relate to them, but I think that makes them more complex and therefore more interesting.
That's why I like some of the more modern movies where they actually explore the stories of the villain so that you get to know them a little bit more. There's a lot of gray area. So, appreciate that very much. Do you have a favorite number and why?
Since I was a kid, my favorite number was 13. I think because no one else wanted it. I always just liked that there was never any fighting over it. In fact, I have a really strong memory of winning two school raffles because no one wanted ticket 13.
Amazing.
I have a tendency to like things because I feel like maybe other people don't appreciate them enough.
I think that's a really good point, actually. And I think that's something that's going to come up a lot in this conversation.
Definitely.
Is there such a thing as objective beauty?
I would say no. I think there's such a thing as agreed upon beauty standard.
Mm-hmm.
But that changes over time. And that's the benefit of being able to look at art through such a long period, is that we're able to see, at least in terms of beauty of ourselves, that has changed so drastically over the centuries. Entirely unreliable, because the things that survive are subjective as well. But there's standards of beauty that I think are interesting. If anything, beauty is one of those ones that cannot be pinned down, and that's why it's so special.
And I was just thinking too, obviously there's standards of beauty in terms of what humans look like, but in terms of landscape or other things that we would call beautiful.
Well, what I love is that for every sunny, bucolic landscape painting, there is someone who painted a lighthouse at night.
Mm-hmm.
Someone's always looking for the other perspective. And that's where I live quite comfortably. And I think there can be mass agreements on beauty, but I don't think there's a definitive rule for beauty.
Love that answer.
I do have a quote about beauty that I thought was really interesting. It's one of my favorites from a Canadian artist, Agnes Martin. Beauty's in your mind, not in the rose. And that because all of our minds are different, so is our beauty.
Mm-hmm. It's also representative of everything is in your mind.
Exactly so.
You know, not just beauty, but everything. Perception of everything. It's how we look at it, how the meaning we choose to place on the things that we witness, the things that we experience. Well, we can absolutely just leave it there, and we'll be talking about that later for sure. If you were given an all-expenses-paid trip, where would you go?
I'm not a big travel person, usually. I'm very much a homebody. I'm like the opposite of you. And it's like, I find that life itself is kind of adventurous enough in a lot of ways. But one of my favorite places I ever went to was Kyoto. And I would go back there with no hesitation. But I also would really like to see the Arctic Circle.
And I would say, too, I had a very different definition of adventure. And I would say that the last 5 years that definition has shifted for me quite significantly. Mm. And I really appreciate the adventure of the everyday in a way that I didn't before. So we're slowly coming to meet in the middle on certain
Which
things.
Which is very unexpected considering our trajectories previously.
Yeah. Which I'm really looking forward to exploring in this conversation. Mm. What's your favorite time within a 24-hour period?
Nighttime, without a doubt. Everything gets quiet. Everything shifts to being almost like another planet. And especially, as you know, out here, it's dark is dark. It's not like when either of us or I've been living in a city when there's a sort of artificial daylight that happens at night. Out here, it gets pitch black. There's no light pollution. And nature has its own schedule that it gets up to. And that is my favorite. I like that it challenges my senses a little bit. It requires you to sort of open up your perception a little, listen a bit harder, look a bit closer, because I am sort of a person who is always doing that anyway. Enough stimulus quiets down that I can really appreciate the things I wouldn't normally appreciate.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, there's reasons why people seek experiences where one of their senses is dimmed so that they have the other senses come forth. And I think that's why I like meditations that focus on the senses, because you can basically welcome in each one and experience them differently.
My walks at night, I think of a lot like a meditation in a way, because it's just me and a path and occasionally an animal I come across. And that's not relaxing. It's not the right word. It's maybe contemplative.
Mindfulness is living in a contemplative state, being present with what is rather than seeking what is not. You are out there doing your midnight walks and I am
very much asleep by the time I'm out there doing that.
We always joke that Malcolm guards the cave at night and I guard the cave in the morning.
And then we occasionally have a crossover text before I go to sleep and when you first wake up.
Yeah. If you could change your name to anything, would you? And what would it be?
When I was a kid, I really didn't like being named Malcolm because it felt like it drew more attention to me as maybe a bit more of an outlier, because when we grew up in Canada, Malcolm was really not a common name. Mm. And then when I moved to England, it was a little bit more common, but still pretty unusual. And you can't imagine the variations of spelling that exist. But now I have a hard time imagining something that suits me better. I guess maybe I've grown into it. Mm. I know I dodged a bullet with another baby name that my mom was considering. So I will take Malcolm and I will appreciate it for the rest of my life, I think.
Okay, amazing. You have survived the weird and wonderful questions.
Oh, that was fine. I was expecting way worse.
I always like to start these episodes with a bit of an origin story. So obviously, I had front row seats to this entire show.
Well, most
of the show. I would love for you to share where you grew up and what were you passionate about growing up? Mm.
I grew up in London, Ontario, which is funny because then I ended up in the London namesake in England. I grew up in London, Ontario until I was, I think, 12. And then we moved to England. We were in Oxford at first, and I did the rest of my schooling there. And before graduating my foundation in art and moving to London, England, to do my bachelor's degree in fine art there. And now I am back in Canada again, and I've set up my studio here.
What sort of things were you passionate about growing up?
It's kind of always been art, really. My mom talks about how quickly she knew that was going to be the area that I was interested in. It hasn't really deviated that far. I mean, I went through the usual phases that I think a lot of kids go through, where I was really interested in dinosaurs, interested in space. I was really interested in marine biology. I think those are the three big ones. But I think that also comes with realizing how expansive the world is at such a young age.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost hard to fathom what is out there and what is available and what the extent of our world that we knew as young children was such a small part of what else is out there. And I think that normal, healthy, universal exploration stuff. And of course, my interest in all of those things manifested in little mini artworks, paintings, right, or doodles or sculptures or ceramics or whatever. So it was always kind of going to be art. It wasn't just immediately obvious what final form that would take.
Well, and I mean, is there a final form?
Not really. I think you ask any artist and they're never 100% sure that they're going to stick with a medium forever. And I think that's just because we're always looking for the perfect way to express an idea. Mm-hmm. And ideas are really hard to make corporeal. So any trick we can find, anything new we can experience, anything we can try and adopt or utilize becomes very seductive.
When is your first memory of art and thinking that that was something that you wanted to pursue?
I guess that would be at school when I think I wrote a report on an artist. I wish I could remember which one it was. I realized that that's all they did every day.
Mm.
And that was a mind-blowing kind of experience for me. And of course, so many artists don't have that luxury and have to do all sorts of things to keep themselves able to make their work, or even able to be in the state of possibly making work, because there's no guarantee of production. But someone can still very much be an artist. But it was the idea that you could give yourself completely to it. And that was very attractive to me. And I think I must have been 8, and just being very fascinated with that.
I wonder if your report was on Frida Kahlo.
Probably. I've always been a big fan. And I remember when I saw her work, it was so visceral that mm-hmm. it felt like it was almost something I shouldn't be looking at as a kid, because everything was so laid bare. There's straightforward stuff like the nudity elements, but at the same time, she addressed a lot of pain and experience in her work, and her life was so challenging in so many ways that it felt like it was almost too much for me to comprehend at that age.
Mm-hmm.
And as I've gotten older, I've only come to appreciate her more.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny to me that obviously you very clearly had artistic talent and I did not. I'm good at other stuff.
You're good at lots of stuff that I'm not good at. So,
well, we're two sides of the coin, which has been something that I've really come to appreciate deeply over the years as we've gotten to know each other more. I had quite a negative experience with art at high school in terms of having a teacher basically tell me that I had zero talent and shouldn't come back because I dragged the grade average down.
Oh, no.
But I would have to say, like, in later years, especially through the growth of our friendship, you've encouraged me to see myself as creative through different avenues. And one of the very vivid memories that I have from childhood, which actually we've talked about this and we're going to talk about memory today, I actually don't have a lot of memories from childhood. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a running family joke that
you just have to keep reminding you that you had a good childhood.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Mom's like, do you remember that birthday party that we threw for you? I'm like, no. You had a great time.
I was there.
But you have an incredible memory. And so I've almost grown up relying on you filling in the blanks for me, which I am really grateful for. But what I do have very vivid memories of growing up was your love of magic.
Mm.
It's amazing to me that some of my clearest memories from a time in my life where I don't have a lot are of things like that, and just watching you be this beautiful representation of someone who just loved what they loved. What do you think it was about magic, and I'm saying that in the widest sense of the term, that really appealed to you?
Like you say, it's magic in a broad sense, in that it encompasses stage magic, magic and illusions. And I think it's probably the same sort of thing that I love about learning about how films are made. For example, how do things that seem impossible happen? What is that feeling we get in our bodies when we see something that, even though we've told ourselves isn't possible, it looks possible? How easy are we to fool? How easy is it to be maybe overtaken by that sensation that there is maybe something we don't understand that could be out there? I mean, that sort of thing is, it's always been something that I found drew me. And I wasn't really sure why for the longest time, but I didn't really question it. It felt special. It felt like every person experienced it differently. It felt like something that was written about and talked about and explored and celebrated. Something about going to a darkened space and being shown something that couldn't possibly be real, but felt like something. To make a feeling out of nothing.
Well, in listening to you talk about that, when I go to an art gallery of one of your shows, that's exactly the environment you create. Mm. I think that that's really amazing to see that through line of something you were really passionate about. Usually when I do these interviews, I ask, you know, is it a forever and always, a light bulb moment, oh, burn?
Forever and always.
Forever and always. And I think that there's something so wonderful about that. But you've also navigated many different ways of bringing this forward in the world through the work that you do. And I don't even necessarily want to call it work, because it really is a calling to create what you feel you have to.
Yeah, I prefer to it more as like a compulsion.
Mm.
It's sort of an itch, or no, an itch sounds unpleasant, but it's more you feel a urge to share that sensation or something that brought you to that sensation. And it's not necessarily about sharing it with as many people as possible. Even one person can be enough. It's holding a mirror up to the world in a way that you can see and you want other people to maybe notice. It's noticing something that maybe otherwise is ignored or passed by, that you've picked up on, that you want to celebrate. And I think, you know, I've said before when I've talked about my work, they end up sort of like love letters at first to the thing that I want to focus on. And that could be anything. That could be the way something produces a specific sound, or the way a slant of light looks on something, or the way wind moves through something. It's very sensory. It's usually something very small that is only noticed when everything else around it is removed.
Mm.
It's putting a spotlight, which works for me very much in a dark room, on something unexpected without the desire for shock or sensationalism, but rather maybe with a sort of attempt to kind of capture it in enough of a way that it stays around longer than it would in nature.
This is sort of foundational in terms of all the directions I wanted to go with this conversation. I can see how we can talk about capturing the essence of something. And I know that a big part of your work, which also directly echoes the way that you live your life in a sort of minimalist fashion, which is distilling something down to its essence to see if it's recognizable enough to spark a memory or to elicit some kind of reaction in someone. And I guess that's where it kind of brings me forward with magic and illusion, and basically you becoming an illusionist. But maybe we could talk a little bit about that and just how you came to discover and really understand how to do that. I spend the majority of my time listening to you talk about your work just in wonder, because our minds operate in very different ways. I do want to talk a little bit later about how we've, the time when we really did first bond over our shared work was in our reverence of nature and the preservation of it. Although we had very different approaches to that preservation. And I do want to talk about that. But before we do that, I would love to talk about this through line of magic and illusion and memory and why that's been so central.
I think I see illusion as a method of recreating something externally that would otherwise just be in memory. So much of memory, like we think it's high definition surround sound kind of experience, and it's really not. It's fragments of things. That's where sort of the science element comes in for me, because obviously I work a lot with computers, but also I'm very interested in how the brain perceives memory and illusion, because they're very similar. They're fleeting moments that we theoretically have to recreate to remember. And so the neuroscience of memory is really interesting to me. And I love the ideas of pattern recognition. I love the ideas of the ability to identify an object and how much information we need to identify that. And it's sort of the same thing you think of when you think of a ghost of someone. In your mind, when you think of a ghost, you think of either, well, there's the classic white sheet, but let's gloss over that. But mostly we think of sort of a translucent, shimmering form of someone. And I guess memories are like that, and we don't have the complete information. They're not necessarily set in stone. And so the ephemerality of it is appealing to me, because I guess it's the most accurate way that you can present something like a memory is to make an illusion. And whether that's sophisticated, like a simulation, or whether that's really simple, like a trick of light with a mirror, makes really no difference to me, as long as it elicits the same feeling first in me. And then if it does that for other people, that's a bonus.
Well, and it's really interesting, because the last couple of episodes have been one with a musician, another with a poet, talking about creating something and you have an intention behind it. Mm-hmm. And how do you navigate that sort of letting go of something out into the world and letting people place their own perception on it when it's something that's so personal?
Mm. Well, the letting go is the hardest bit, I think, because I don't think any artist has ever actually necessarily finished working on something.
Mm.
I've worked on things with more kind of commercial application where the deadline comes and you know that you could keep fiddling with it for a long time and you have to sort of make your peace with it. But I've been very lucky that that is mostly behind me, and I don't really experience that too often now. In terms of other people's perception, for me, I can't speak to other artists or other creative people, but where I start is for me. I don't necessarily need to tell people my memory of something so that they experience it in exactly the way that I experienced it. That's not really the goal for me. In fact, if anything, the reduction and refinement of something is an opportunity to not only present something the way that I see it in my own mind, but also in such a purified form that it gives people opportunity to make their own connection with it. And that's always been quite a joy when I'm showing a piece of work and somebody says, oh, this makes me think of dot, dot, dot. It reminds me of a memory from when I was a kid when dot, dot, dot. That is absolutely the goal. And some of them have been wildly far from the source material. And I almost love those more, because you don't know what's going to happen when you put it out there. That's the scary thing about it. And the vulnerable thing about being an artist, I think, is putting it out there. And I don't know if you necessarily hope someone's going to like it specifically, but you hope that it's going to connect with somebody. And the connection is the bit that I think is really important, because I'm not a I'm not a naturally social person in a traditional sense, but the most profound connections that I've made with people have been with discussing work. And I think that's part of why our relationship is so good, because I talk to you and I show you things before they're finished, and when they're finished, before anyone else sees them. And we have a great opportunity to react to things together. And I love watching you react to things, because I know you come at it with a completely different tool set and memory set to me. I'm not looking to create something just from our shared memory. I'm looking to create something from my perspective. And I know you've seen things I will probably never see. And what it makes you feel won't be what it makes me feel. And I love that. And it means that I'm hitting on something that can maybe apply to more journeys than just my own.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that's just valuable in life, is to seek others who are not just in an echo chamber. Mm. Seek people who are very different from you, see the world in a different way, have a different skill set, memory set, experience set, so that when we're having conversation, we're evolving.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's very easy to seek the comfort of people that agree with you.
But not only that, and I was going to say that the other thing that's really important is people who are honest.
Yes.
Because it's very easy to someone just to pat you on the head and go, okay, you did it. Well done. It looks great. And I think most artists would say they need to know that if you don't like something, that you'll tell them. I'm very lucky in that I have a small collection of close friends who I know I can send something to, and they will tell me absolutely how they feel about something. And that is a nice feeling. It's sort of a pre-release release. And then you either, it's funny because it's like trying to decide between one thing and another. Either you're sure that you know that's what you want when you hear other people react to it, or when they say the other, you instinctually have a repulse reaction or a tension reaction, and you go, okay, this was my insecurity about it all along. I should have listened to that and I should have acted on that. And then sometimes things go back to the drawing board, and that is very much part of the process.
Once again, I think that's just such a wider life lesson in general. It's also finding a balance, as you said, between following your own intuition and having a trusted group of people that you can bounce ideas off of, or if you're having to make big decisions, you're learning to trust yourself, but then also having a trustworthy peanut gallery. Mm-hmm. Who, as you said, are willing to bring honesty to the table, knowing that there really isn't right or wrong, especially when it comes to art. Like, there isn't. There are no rules.
Yeah, and that was always my problem in educational setting with art. I went through art school in a very traditional sense, and I always thought it was really difficult to set down criteria for assessing artwork, because it's so personal, because it's so subjective. How do you place value on something? Or in a more binary way, do you pass or fail something? How do we decide something is successful or not? And when you realize that group of five people, for example, who are deciding, could be a completely different group of five people and give you a completely different reaction.
This also echoes when we place value on things like nature.
Mm-hmm.
Can we not just value it for its intrinsic value versus what else it can offer?
Well, it's the sort of natural growing field versus the lawn, isn't it? We want our lawns to be very straight up and down and a very specific length, and we don't want any weeds growing in it, and we want everything to be lined up and well watered, and we don't want any brown patches. That's very much against nature's nature. It doesn't want to do any of those things, and we're exerting an attempt at control over it, and although usually to our detriment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm so pleased to see things like pollinator beds becoming so popular and naturally occurring gardens. And, you know, while we live, we're lucky that everything is, for the most part, very wild and very naturally growing. You have to cut out bits of grass so that you can get from point A to point B. But otherwise, what we have is a natural ecosystem that we are accepting as beautiful, because I don't think we only see the beauty in it. We also see the function in it.
Mm-hmm. And that it's thriving.
Without us.
Without
us touching it. Our desire to control nature should not be part of our ability to make decisions around it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think some people have a hard time saying, okay, nature's just going to do what nature's going to do. That's a hard thing for some people to accept. It implies a certain amount of hands off the wheel that some people are not comfortable with. But we are a component of nature. We are not separate from nature. So by trying to control it, just our own inability to accept what seems chaotic or natural.
Mm-hmm. And that leads perfectly into what I hinted at earlier in terms of the first time that we really connected. We went very different directions, I would say, with life. And for a long time, we didn't seem to be able to connect on much, which is fine. You know, I look back on that now, knowing that everything unfolded perfectly. When I first really started to connect with you was when your work started being really informed by nature, natural cycles and systems, with a real focus on the preservation of nature, although very different from my approach, which has always been boots on the ground, present moment, raising awareness, or actually taking physical action to protect nature with the intention of preserving it for future generations to ensure that they're able to experience this incredible planet that we live on in the same way that we are so lucky to do so. And I remember almost like a light switch that went on when I was looking at your work, when I realized that we were both preserving nature for future experience, but in very different ways. I was boots on the ground doing public speaking and going on expeditions and doing things in a way that made sense for me. And then I look over and I'm thinking, Malcolm's preserving the essence of nature for future experience.
That might also have something to do with our perspectives on humanity. I mean, I would love to be the eternal optimist and say, okay, we're going to figure it out. We're going to learn how to coexist with nature in a way that doesn't completely destroy it. But even looking at the shifts in biodiversity over time, I feel compelled to preserve the things that I think are special. And those may not be, I think I said before, you know, we don't consider ourselves part of nature, but we very much are.
Mm-hmm.
And those may be down to human interaction, and they may be, or they may be just a human and something out in what we would call nature. It's sort of the same way I feel about memories. It's the preserving a memory of nature is very much sort of the underlying theme. And it took a while for that to even present itself to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think most artists would tell you they follow their gut in a certain amount of ways to see what comes of exploration and what comes of personal thought. And what I found more often than not was that I was worried that these fleeting moments, that memory wouldn't be enough, or that you could never tell a story of that memory as well as you could try to capture and show it in a different way. And that very much dictated material as well for me. I mean, obviously there are other components, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, eventually. But the use of digital is not like, I'm not using technology because I think technology is necessarily inspiring, but rather because it's the best tool to express this ephemerality and fleeting nature of what I'm showing. Back in the day, I probably would have used a very different media, but I would have wanted to accomplish the same result. And technology it feels ephemeral. It feels vulnerable a lot of the time. As you know, like when I'm setting things up, things go wrong.
Yeah.
So there's a vulnerability to the work and a potential that formats will become outdated or display technology will become outdated to the point where either the work stops and it's gone or it takes on a different form. So in a way, it is very much like human memory in that we do have to preserve it. We do have to take care of it. And so it's a double preservation, preserving a feeling from nature in a medium that also needs to be preserved. But maybe it's an attempt to create a backup copy and saying, okay, if the worst happens, we have this. And it's not exactly the same, but it's close enough that maybe we can still use it to either remind ourselves of how special something was or try to explain to someone how special something was.
And I think it's really interesting if you look at storytelling that's really compelling to a lot of people right now, tends to be sort of post-apocalyptic.
Mm.
What would life be like if we lost all of these things as we face significant degradation of this amazing planet that we are so lucky to live on? I'm sure that people are picking up once again that we're two sides of a coin in terms of I am the eternal optimist that we will find ways to live in harmony with nature. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't have to navigate really difficult emotions when I look at what's happening in the world. It can be very easy to be flooded with pessimism and to lose this hope that I feel very deeply within myself that there is a massive shift happening in the world. I think it's a really exciting time to be alive. Just to nod to technology again, in terms of seeing the solutions that are coming out of technology to preserve nature, to protect it. And so I think this is just a very cool conversation that I know we have quite regularly.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping that by sharing this through the podcast, that this might encourage other people to have this type of conversation as well when it comes to the diversity of ways that we can protect the things that we love. Especially given that this podcast was really inspired by the fact that people are out there loving things so intensely that they're willing to shape their life around it.
It's strange because, you know, you mentioned popular culture and talking about these post-apocalyptic scenarios, these ones that are sort of almost post-human, where something very drastic has happened. We're often shown a world where nature just reacts and just fills in the void that we leave behind.
Right.
And we talk about science fiction, but in reality, a lot of it really belongs probably more under the heading of speculative fiction, where it's more sort of, okay, if we stopped producing pollution right now, cars disappeared, if all the buildings stopped using air conditioning and so on, nature would just fill it back in. The concrete would eventually crumble. The roads would fall apart. Everything that we've built, we're constantly attempting to fight to keep from being reabsorbed. And I think maybe some of us are scared of the idea that we are a blip compared to the scale of other things that are at play.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I like playing with scale in my work as well. Sometimes you can feel really dwarfed by it. And sometimes it feels like it could fit inside the palm of your hand. And I think our scale within things is always very important. And that's certainly something I think about a lot when I'm making something, is how do I want the person to feel in terms of how they absorb the work? Do I want them to feel dwarfed by it? Do I want them to feel like it's part of a larger beauty? Or is it something that they could have missed that they would have walked by every day?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason things crop up in science fiction, for example. It's a very comfortable way for us to workshop our anxieties about things, but also maybe to humble ourselves a little bit and to recognize that we're here for a very short period of time on a very small scale compared to everything else. And what matters to us in the moment will not mean anything necessarily to someone later. So not really much is reflected my medium in terms of whether it's something like a piece of software on a screen or a projection, or something in glass or something in mirror, which are sort of the mediums I work in the most, is that it can be broken. It is maybe more long-term than a human would be, but still in the scale of nature, short-lived. That makes that precious and worth enjoying and sharing and protecting.
I just love listening to you talk about this. You know, I think there's a couple of really interesting points there. One is that we need to be very introspective with ourselves when we think about environmental degradation and our concerns about it. Is our concern for the health of the planet, or is our concern for the health of humanity and the future of humanity? And as you said, realistically, nature will take over. It was thriving before we got here, and it will thrive again in a different form.
We don't think about this, the cycles that nature goes through. And there have been extinction events where life has been wiped clean and had to start over again for either some species or in some cases for most of the planet. We realize that we will eventually probably face a human extinction event unless we find ways to preserve ourselves. But the cost has to be aligned with that.
I think this is why I really enjoy meditation and exploring meditation, but I find a lot of solace in feeling small, in feeling like I'm just a speck of dust in the grand scheme. And I know for others that can be extremely overwhelming. If I think about expeditions that I've been on, when I'm on the top of a mountain or I'm in the middle of the ocean where I'm closer to people on the space station than I am to people on land, that's when I feel most inspired, is when I feel infinitesimal.
Do you think that's because it means that everything that you worry about in your day-to-day is nothing comparatively?
Yes, absolutely. And that's something that I've been very conscious about with those trips, is understanding that I just have to get from point A to point B alive, whilst also delivering on what I set out to do, which is either to preserve something, to capture and communicate the need to preserve something. You know, there's always been purpose in my exploration. But I think actually, like I was talking about earlier, my definition of adventure has shifted so dramatically in the last 5 years, in that the greatest adventure I've ever been on has actually been going into my own head and better understanding myself. And I think that for me, you've really inspired me to go on that journey, because this is something that you've always done. I lived so externally for such a long time. And I think that, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that you have lived very internally. And for me, the idea that I should just disappear into my own head, it's a different type of adventure. But as you said, going on those adventures was almost an escape of the everyday. And now I feel more brave showing up for navigating my crunchy emotions and things that happen on a daily basis than I do about climbing a mountain or crossing an ocean.
Because we realize that those components are mechanical in a lot of ways. We know that if we do things a certain way, that we can do them. Whereas when it comes to things in your head, there's not so many hard and fast rules that we can rely on. It has to be very much from your own angle of approach.
Learning to map the inner landscape of your mind is definitely the most rewarding challenge that I've undertaken. And it's allowed me to be humbled in a very different way, to live in humility every day, to just be grateful for being alive, not distracting myself from the presence of simply being, and changing my understanding of my value on the planet just being alive. Mm. I really wanted you to know that that has been very inspiring to me in the last 5 years, to realize I'm not catching up with you in a certain way, but I feel like I can better understand your journey now that I've been brave enough to do a little piece of it myself. I was thinking about like light and shadow, and how as we've gotten older, those lines have blurred much more for both of us, I think. Mm-hmm. I've been more willing to explore my shadow side and do my inner work, which is something that you've always done. You've never shied away from just being yourself. And I remember you so vividly, you saying to me, I never felt like I had another option.
So maybe that was a result of the lack of internal work, though. I worry about that sometimes, that I was just living on the edge of my feelings all the time. But then when you get used to that, it becomes a real gift. And I think it comes with any kind of sensitivity towards something. It's recognition that you are in a vehicle with as much information as you can absorb, but really you are on your own doing the best with what you've got. And I think you tend to find that with people who would be maybe described as loners or people who are a bit more solitary, is that they have done all of that because they're not afraid of being left alone with those thoughts, or they're not afraid of being left alone in the theoretical darkness and hashing out things that are in there. And I know in my mind that I can go to that place without feeling threatened or vulnerable or scared, because I think if anyone who's gone through much of anything in their life can say, you have to have things to measure your feelings off of. And I've watched you go off and have these incredible physical journeys, and they've comparatively terrified me. I don't see myself as somebody who could necessarily go on the sort of things that you went on expedition-wise. I think I could do it, but I think so much of what my life is about being internal and about the quiet and the introspective, that it would be almost more of a challenge to do it with people. I know what my brain is capable of theoretically, and I know what I'm comfortable with, and I know how I would approach solving problems, because I'm constantly solving problems. And I think any artist would agree with that, or actually anybody, to be honest, is that you are forever putting out fires in your own head before you have to actually do them in real life. Mm. And I find that very calming, thankfully. I've already played out every potential eventuality. I feel better going into the world.
The benefit of doing, I call it the inner work for want of a better phrase, is learning to enjoy solitude and enjoy being with yourself, even when you're experiencing challenging things and challenging emotions, to learn to trust yourself, to know that you can navigate those things. And that's been the cool thing, is trying to find a little bit more of that balance. I would say that one of the hardest challenges is being lonely in a group of people. Mm. At least I find that more and more, is that as I came home to myself, everywhere that I go, I am far better able to just be there.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's sort of, you get the occasional person who's like, oh, I can't be alone with my own thoughts. Mm. And that has never been a problem for me at all. I guess because I was never trying to fill the void to not hear them. Mm-hmm. I've always kind of been in my own thoughts. And I think that's, I'm hesitant to say that any one kid is more imaginative than another or more sensitive than another, because I think it all comes down to personal levels. But I was always very imaginative, and I was always mentally creating something. And I think it maybe comes with the scope of doing that constantly in your head, means that you're not afraid to have those conversations, and failures in your mind don't constitute failures in real life. So there's a sort of safety net of working in your head first. But the problem that comes with that then, is as a creative person or as an artist, is that you then have to make the thing. which can be challenging. And in my case, I have a tendency to come up with things that I've not done before. You kind of start fresh every time. And that is both terrifying and exhilarating, I think, in equal measure. You have to do the idea justice rather than going the other way around. You have to go, okay, what is the best way to get this across? And then humble yourself before the process of doing that. And whatever the best way to make it is, that's going to be what you're going to do, because the idea deserves it, or the thing that you care about so much to make an idea about it deserves it. So I certainly am always trying to do the best from what I consider an internal workshop to suss out the things that I think are, in my opinion, either at risk or worth saving or worth capturing or worth honoring. And that's very much the process for everything that I make.
Well, then I love your use of the word honoring there, because I know that over the years, there's been different things that have inspired you in terms of your process and your approach, not just your work, but your life as well. And I know that right at the beginning of the conversation, you were like, I'm not really a traveler, but you did mention Kyoto. And I know that Japan and Japanese culture over the years has certainly been a very big source of inspiration for you. And so I'm wondering if you might let us in on a little bit about why that is.
I think at first it was an aesthetic connection. If you look at historical art from Japan, the identity revolves around the beauty of simplicity, the beauty of negative space, the beauty of maybe the unexpected. I think what appealed to me about Japan at first was the aesthetic that I'd experienced through historical art and film. And, you know, that's not necessarily a realistic representation of Japan now, but there's certain pockets of that that have remained preserved. And I think that's maybe part of the culture that really resonates with me, is although you have these incredible technological breakthroughs and it does feel more advanced technologically there, that there is also this real respect for tradition and history and culture in a way that is preserved. And that may be a turn of phrase, or it may be a tradition or a ritual element of everyday life, or a festival, or anything really. But there is a reverence for past, and there's a reverence for, I think historically, there's a reverence for quiet and solitude. Again, we're talking about this sort of not loneliness, but solitude. And I think that's very much in line with Zen Buddhism and Shinto from those time periods in Japan's history, where it was about honoring nature and about representing the simplicity of the beauty of nature, or at least the perceived beauty of nature, in the cleanest way possible. Because any culture is capable of producing very Baroque, very detailed, very extravagant works of art. And there certainly are pieces of that in history in Japan as well. But the pieces that really spoke to me were always these historical pieces done either in black lacquer or ink, or done as inlay, or done as these tiny little objects. They felt like a celebration of one thing. And that's, I think, what really drew me to Japanese art, especially, is there's a period there where things that were for everyday life, for the most part, because ritual was so part of an everyday life there, became moments to celebrate something uniquely. We talk about a folding screen, for example, or a tea caddy, or a tray, and they're decorated in the most extravagant way, but with the most restraint. And I think the beauty of the restraint is that it sings out a very singular note of celebration for that one thing. It makes it about the way the light plays on the water or the way the wind captures a leaf. It's about those little tiny moments, and they're frozen in time in such a pristine way that I knew there was some, culturally anyway, some kindred spirits there with what I was attempting to do as an artist. And you see a lot of that when you get there as well. Although there is also parts like for Tokyo, for example, there's incredibly detailed and you're being bombarded with sound and light and noise. And then you turn a corner and it's a little pedestrian street and everything's lit with paper lanterns. And you have that juxtaposition that I guess also exists in my work. I use technology to make something that feels less about technology and less about the digital and more about the feeling. So even though they've evolved so far from their aesthetic beginnings, there is still a reverence for simplicity and the hand and the quiet that resonates with me still and keeps me coming back.
I've obviously experienced your work, and I'm hoping that people who are listening will visit your website and maybe get a chance to catch a show at some point. But hearing you talk about that celebration of a singular note, it makes me reflect on past shows of yours that I've been to where I think that's exactly what you've done. Each piece is a distilled note, a hint, a memory of something, but that all together, the show is a harmony, or it's a melody that is an ode to the theme that you're bringing together with all the different notes. So That was a really cool moment for me to just listen to you say that. Even though we talk every day, you know.
I know, and we still haven't talked about that, so.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's the beauty of these conversations too, and what process of starting this podcast has done for me is just asking things in a different way and deep listening so that we can all get to know each other a little bit better. How do we see the world? As we were talking about at the beginning, the perception, our perception is everything.
The foundation of art is this desire to share a perception. It's a desire to share the way that you see the world. It doesn't necessarily demand that you do see it the same way. It's an outreach experience. This is how I see things. This is what I value. This is what I cherish. Maybe someone out there will feel the same way. And they might not feel the same way from the same direction, but they might be able to value what you value in a similar enough way that you can find people that you connect with. And that's always been a bit of a surprise, really, was people who come out of the blue and message you or send you an email and say, this really spoke to me or connected with me. That's the magic of what art can do if you're not someone who is social in a traditional sense. The work has always spoken more about me than I could ever do. This is a new thing, the interviewing element, but the work has usually been the interview.
And I'm honored that you know, you came on the show, and once again, you've come outside of your comfort zone to be on the show, and I really recognize that, and I honor that too. And I was just thinking, to sort of wrap up that piece around why you're so inspired by Japan, I remember you introducing me to the Japanese philosophy of ma, which is between the breath, pause, space. And I was just listening to you talk about creating the art, but then it's giving it the space to be interpreted in a different way. It's giving it that breath for introspection. And I remember watching this video of this wonderful woman explaining this philosophy and saying that even in Japanese business meetings, there are cultivated moments of silence so that people can take a moment to collect their thoughts, gift everyone that space for response rather than reaction. And that's certainly something that I've been cultivating in my own mind and in the way that I live my life by being more meditative, contemplative, present, gifting myself the space between things. And so just listening to you there, I hadn't really put two and two together in terms of experiencing an artwork within that framework to say it's created, it's there, and then the space is given for all of us to sort of come in and have our own perception of it. So,
well, and it's funny to talk about this, you know, because I'm not 100% on this. I'll have to check, but I seem to remember that the characters for Ma are the shape of a gate.
Mm. No, I think you're right.
It's such a perfect representation of the philosophy. And that, of course, is something that Japan historically has done exceptionally well, is that there's been meaning to every movement. And what may seem like unnecessary ritual or unnecessary behavior is actually loaded with meaning and feeling. And, you know, we talk about that juxtaposition of technology and history. And I remember walking through Shinjuku and it's apartment buildings and office buildings, and they're all different, which is part of the joy of Japanese architecture, is that it seems to be fearless. And then coming across this patch where light seemed to fall off and set back away from the road a little bit was this shrine in the middle of town, mm-hmm. on the middle of a busy street with taxis going past and billboards, and having this small wooden shrine essentially in darkness, recessed from the street, was this breath, this moment, this quiet. And I chase those kind of sensations both with my work and personally. And that part of what really drew me to come and move back out here and be your neighbor is that quiet is a real luxury in terms mm-hmm. of thought and in terms of making sure that you have the capacity to give significance to the things that matter to you.
I think that is such a beautiful place to ask you the main question that I ask in all of these interviews, if that's okay with you. Mm-hmm. What do you think is the meaning and purpose of life, the universe, and everything?
I've heard so many people answer this. So different every time that I'm kind of a bit daunted by it. But I can tell you what I think the purpose is as far as I'm concerned. And I think it is to seek out beauty. And I don't mean beauty in a prescribed way or in a way that, oh, that's pleasant to look at or that's easy to look at, but rather seek out what you specifically find beautiful, and whether you have to make it or whether you have to expose yourself to endless things to find it, I think it's a journey worth taking. And I really am a real proponent of feeding your head as much as possible. And whether that's literature, painting, sculpture, music, film, absorb everything. Because you will find things within that where people see the same thing that you do, or they shine a light on something in a way that you normally wouldn't.
That's the perfect Malcolm answer.
The quest for beauty is, what else is there to live for, really? It really could be anything. I think we prescribe beauty as a very specific thing when in fact it's sort of more synonymous with joy.
Right. It's everywhere.
And it takes all sorts of crazy forms. And allow yourself to be surprised by what you find beautiful.
Yes, I love that. So before we wrap up, I would love if you can tell us a little bit about where people can find you and your work, and maybe a little bit about what's up next.
Yes. So the easiest place to find me is either on Instagram. If you search my name, it's Malcolm Pate with an underscore on either side of it. Or malcolmpate.com is my website, which has basically a portfolio on it if they want to have a look. If I have a show coming up, Instagram, I'll usually be posting about it and letting people know. Just working on new projects and excited to share new things with people.
And before we end the conversation, you could tell us what cause you've chosen for the recreation donation this month.
Okay, so I've chosen a cause that's called Spark, which is done through the National Gallery of Canada. And it's incredible, actually, because it's a conversation-based program. It's a free program, but it's designed for people living with dementia, Alzheimer's, and their care partners, which is something that is very close to my heart and lines up really well with my focus on memory. And I think it's important work. They talk to people about works of art in the gallery collection. So they try to have conversations about them, see if they're evocative for certain people, and then talk about those memories. And they also have recently launched a digital version where you can do something over Zoom, if, for example, if you're not able to get to the gallery. And I think that the more accessible that we can make art, the better. And I think the more, as I said before, that search for beauty, whatever shape that is, it's going to enrich your life.
Thank you so much for choosing this cause. I think it's really innovative and I'm really excited to support it. And I know that you very kindly are going to match funding this month. So
absolutely.
Instead of $100, we've got $200 going towards this incredible group. I've watched programming around how powerful experience of music can be for dementia patients. And I think that doing the same with something like art, I mean, beauty in different forms, as you said, all different shapes and forms. Mm-hmm. I think this is a spectacular choice for this month's recreation donation. So thank you so much.
My pleasure.
So you have survived. You live through this interview, Malcolm. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I am so honored that you sat down to have this conversation with me. And as always, I leave with so much to contemplate and just so much gratitude that I get to have these conversations with you every day.
I can't think of anyone I'd like to have the conversation with more.
This month's recreation donation is in support of the Spark program at the National Gallery of Canada. As you now know from exploring with Malcolm and I in this episode, this is a free program for individuals living with dementia and their care partners that invites them into the gallery, either in person or online, to welcome conversation and spark connection through viewing art together. Whether you can volunteer your time, money, or your voice, we hope you'll head over to our Patreon page to find out the different ways you can support their unique version of Recreation for the World. Please take the time to let us know what the stories we explored in this episode meant to you. And if you do take action to support this month's cause, thank you. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Recreation to Recreation. If you or someone you know has a unique and inspiring story to tell, make sure to reach out so we can share it with the world. Until next time, keep happy, keep healthy, and keep exploring.